It's November 15th, 1951, at the Las Vegas courthouse. The smoke-filled room is packed with press, curious citizens, and nervous mobsters. Very nervous mobsters. Their lifeblood, their entire Las Vegas business empire, is on the line. U.S. Senator C. Estes Kefauver and his Senate Special Committee to Investigate Crime in Interstate Commerce are hunting organized crime with a vengeance. At the top of their list are allegations that the mob is skimming taxable profits from Vegas casinos.
Call to the stand Mr. Morris Sedway.
Sedway ambles to the stand. He's short, portly, and wearing a rumpled suit. He's also a shrewd, trusted lieutenant of Chicago mob boss Meyer Lansky. Sedway is a key architect of the syndicate's growing takeover of Vegas. In testimony so far, mobsters are taking the fifth, and Nevada officials called to testify are denying any knowledge of taxable profit skimming. Sedway is part of the underworld, but he keeps a strong front as a legit businessman. For good measure, he's on the board of the local library. He knows a lot, but what he'll say is anybody's guess. Senator Kefauver steps up with a stern look on his face. He wants to nail this thug.
Meyer Lansky is a leader in Chicago organized crime, and he's your boss. He's also the silent owner of the Flamingo Hotel, where you are manager, is he not?
It's all true, of course, but Sedway shrugs.
Mr. Lansky is a business associate who used to own 100 shares in the Flamingo. That's it. Me? I'm in Las Vegas real estate, just trying to make a living for my family.
Kefauver frowns at Sedway and shakes his head. In the gallery, Sedway's Vegas gangland associates exchange worried glances. Sedway's regular guy shtick is clearly riling the senator. Kefauver gets directly to the point.
You've been involved in paying off Nevada officials, haven't you?
It's a common practice. Even respected Nevada Senator Pat McCarran is allegedly on the take. He's tried hard to squash the hearings into the mob's activity in the casinos. Because if the mob gets shut down, Vegas gets shut down, and the state's economy will go into a tailspin. Sedway looks at the senator blankly and clears his throat.
For the record, I have had 3 major coronary thrombosis, and I have had diarrhea for 6 weeks, and I have an ulcer, hemorrhoids, and an intestinal abscess. I just got out of bed, and I am loaded with drugs.
Kefauver is outraged.
Sir, your health is none of my concern. You associate with the scum of the earth, people who are a cancer spot on the body politic.
Suddenly, Sedway becomes serious. Kefauver's touched a nerve.
We don't get as rich as you think, Senator. This is hard work.
What?
In the end, Kefauver's Las Vegas hearings fizzle out thanks to the mob's alliance with the Nevada government. The bosses think they've dodged a bullet. They figure they can keep skimming. Hell, they figure they can expand their holdings. And they will. For now.
If you travel, you know when it comes to love.
See you soon.
Can't wait.
The sky is no limit. You know with your Delta Amex card, being oceans apart means meeting in Aruba. And booking a war travel with your card means saving 15% on Delta flights. You know kissing under the bridge of sighs guarantees eternal love. Because you're the long-distance lovebirds. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Take off 15 discount not applicable to partner-operated flights or taxes and fees. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know.
Tools and Weapons is a podcast exploring the promise and the peril of the digital age, hosted by Microsoft's vice chair and president, Brad Smith. His latest guest is Bayer CEO Bill Anderson. Though many of us know Bayer for its pharmaceuticals, they're also focused on crop science with the goal of making sure no one on planet Earth goes hungry. On Tools and Weapons, Brad and Bill talk about how the German company is using artificial intelligence paired with CRISPR technology to increase food production without fertilizers. Their efforts put AI and digital tools in the hands of farmers to get the most out of every acre on a hotter, more crowded planet. It's the latest conversation in a series that invites listeners to pull up a front row seat to some of the most important developments in technology today. You can check out this episode and a whole lot more of Tools and Weapons with Brad Smith wherever you get your podcasts. From Wondery, I'm David Brown, and this is Business Wars. In our last episode, Las Vegas went from a dusty frontier outpost of card rooms, bars, bootleg liquor, and loose women to a burgeoning gambling mecca. In 1931, the state government legalized gaming. By the 40s, visionary underworld entrepreneurs were moving in, and interference from local authorities was almost non-existent. Now, as the 1950s kick in, mob business is firmly entrenched. The first wave of resort hotels are popping up on the Strip, and thousands of American tourists are drawn to the scent of something new and exciting. The mob-run casinos are racking up record profits, and that will eventually catch the attention of politicians and the feds. But the government investigations have embarrassed Nevada officials, and for the first time, Sin City mobsters are realizing their wildly lucrative business isn't untouchable. Senator Kefauver's anti-Vegas vendetta has been grabbing headlines in his crusade against the gambling mob. Now, the mob's gaming concerns are getting validation from a surprising and very legitimate source: the Mormon world. This is episode 2 of The Birth of Vegas. The feds get fed up. It's December 1951 on a Tuesday night at Guarino's Bar in Cleveland, Ohio, a known hangout for local racketeers.
Hey, Nicky, another scotch down here. It's freezing outside.
Two mobsters are settling in at the cozy bar, escaping the brutal winter weather. Ralphie Caputo and Bruno De Rossi are small-time hoodlums, but the city cops are well aware of them. It's a tough existence.
Hey, Ralphie, you read about the Kefauver hearings in Las Vegas?
Damn right I did. Sounds like the feds couldn't nail him for nothing. They got a good deal going over there.
You bet they do. It's about 60 degrees warmer than here. We're freezing our asses off. For what? A bunch of minor hustles?
And the cops around here are on us like white on rice.
De Rossi glances furtively up and down the bar. Then he leans in close.
I hear some of the crew in Detroit and Jersey are moving out to Vegas. I'm thinking we should too. The city's wide open. Guys in our industry can thrive out there.
Industry?
Our business, our line of work, you coglione.
Kefauver's hearings may have rattled the Vegas mob hierarchy, but they're publicized on TV, radio, and headlines nationwide. It all amounts to a detailed, mouth-watering advertisement for the fact that Sin City is a welcoming haven for organized criminal activity. Now, crooks around the country, tired of dealing with regional law enforcement, are flocking to Vegas. The crooked migration will cement the illicit power base in the city's business community. Sin City is a land of dark opportunity in the bright, warm sunshine. In the 10 years since the late Bugsy Siegel broke ground on the Flamingo Hotel and Casino, the city has blossomed. Thanks to the mob, resorts are springing up like weeds. The Sahara, the Royal Nevada, the Sands, the Showboat, the Riviera, the Dunes, the Tropicana, and the Stardust all now populate the Strip. But the Kefauver hearings have left a taint of vice on the city. Tourists have to be convinced to visit. So, to combat the city's bad reputation, A small contingent of cunning publicists, writers, and photographers work diligently to sell Vegas to the masses. They create a must-see fantasy that isn't completely reliant on gambling.
Las Vegas, Nevada, the entertainment and fun capital of the world, where the clock never stops and the doors never close. This is the city of daytime sun and nighttime fun.
In the New Vegas, there's golf, swimming, the Hoover Dam, and dude ranches. Tourists can enjoy the natural beauty of Lake Mead and snow-covered Mount Charleston. People also come for the big-name entertainers, the 2-inch steaks, the comp drinks, and the statuesque showgirls. And, of course, the elusive dream of getting rich quick. From different angles, Sin City is either the ultimate version of paradise or a hotbed of tasteless obscenity. Either way, it couldn't be more American. And in the early 50s, there's one more draw that only Las Vegas can offer. Atomic bombs.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
In the aftermath of World War II, America is eager to keep up with the Soviet Union. The U.S. Army tests its nuclear arsenal. The empty expanse of the Nevada desert is the prime area to do that. Giddy crowds of tourists party poolside, guzzling specially mixed atomic cocktails all night. They've gathered to watch the nuclear test at Frenchman's Flat Proving Ground, just 292 miles away.
Wow, look at that. An honest-to-God atomic bomb.
Mushroom clouds can be seen rising from the desert floor.
Oh, wow.
Talk about entertainment. Real bombs, just like they dropped in the war.
The tests create a tremendous spike in tourist business. Hotels are regularly sold out. Savvy Vegas power brokers view the atomic display as an unexpected promotional coup, courtesy of the U.S. Army. And when they're done with all the biggest attractions, tourists are gambling like mad. By 1954, 8 million visitors per year are leaving some $200 million in casino vaults. And in 54, the average American family income is $4,200. But for every $1 million casinos report to the government, the mob is skimming $3 million. The dirty money is distributed to underworld bosses around the country and deposited and laundered in Swiss bank accounts. From there, the money goes to fund the mob's interests in drugs, prostitution, and other illegal concerns. Chicago boss Sam Momo Giancana, a powerful figure who ordered nearly 200 executions during his reign, has total control of the major casinos. His personal take is over $300,000 a month. It's a hell of a business model. But nearly all of the smiling tourists dropping money in the city have one thing in common. They're white. Vegas has a racist past that goes back to the 1930s, when African Americans flocked to jobs building the Hoover Dam and working in magnesium mines. Initially, Western locals welcomed them, but over time, attitudes changed. When white Southern laborers arrived, many of them openly expressed heavily racist attitudes. Mobsters from the East Coast and Midwest were equally bigoted. Strictly enforced Jim Crow laws became the norm. By the early 1950s, black people are not allowed to stay in hotels on the Strip or on Fremont Street, known as Glitter Gulch. Nor can they gamble in casinos, eat in restaurants, swim in the pools, or attend live shows. Hotel and casino brass fear white clientele will be put off by the presence of black people in their establishments. Though one place where black people in Las Vegas are welcome is on stage. The nation's top African-American entertainers headline the showrooms and are paid on the same level as many white acts, up to $50,000 per week.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Sands Hotel takes pleasure in presenting
Mr. Nat King Cole.
Names like Nat King Cole, Ella Fitzgerald, Lena Horne, and Sammy Davis Jr. loom large on glittering marquees up and down the strip. Yet those entertainers can't stay in the primo hotels. Instead, they're sent to cheap rooms in a part of Vegas called the West Side, a rundown area with dirt roads and spotty plumbing. It's literally across the tracks from the white side of town. It's 1952. Jamaican-American singer, actor, and civil rights activist Harry Belafonte has signed on to perform at the Thunderbird Hotel on the Strip. When he arrives at the hotel and announces himself at the reception desk, he's immediately ushered into the manager's office.
Is there a problem?
The manager stares at him and lights a smoke.
No problem, Mr. Belafonte, but you can't stay here. We'll get you a room on the west side. I'm sure it'll do.
I don't think it will. I'd like to stay right here where I'm working. If I can't, then I'll buy out my contract and go home. I won't be performing.
Oh, you won't be performing. If you don't, you'll be going home in a box. You get me?
Belafonte excuses himself and makes a call to a relative who has mob connections. He gets his room, plus rooms for the rest of his black band. But it's not over yet. After the group checks in, Belafonte's piano player is in his room relaxing in front of the TV. The man opens the door and stares. It's Belafonte, wearing a bathrobe and bathing suit. He's got a thick white towel across his shoulders.
What's up, Harry? Get your trunks. We're going swimming.
He does as instructed. The men walk out to the pool. An all-white crowd is swimming happily. As heads turn in astonishment, Belafonte steps out of his robe, letting it drop on a chaise lounge chair. Belafonte's piano player is worried.
Harry, what the hell are you doing?
Belafonte smiles at him and dives in. A few older swimmers climb quickly out of the pool in shock, but the younger people are thrilled. They want photos with Belafonte. He happily obliges. It's a small triumph. For his next appearance at the Thunderbird 3 years later, Belafonte demands and gets the same privileges as any white performer. In 1955, the unimaginable happens. A small group of white investors, along with African-American boxing legend and spokesman Joe Louis, open the first desegregated hotel and casino in Vegas, the Moulin Rouge. It's a $3.5 million luxury resort catering to both black and white patrons, located just off the strip. The showroom is spectacular, the pool enormous, and the entertainment is A-list. The hotel is a hit. The Chorus Girls, the only all-black chorus line in Vegas, make the cover of Life magazine, the most influential publication of the day. But the Moulin Rouge is in debt from day one. Not enough black clientele can afford the expense of the hotel, and the hotel's debt is mounting. 7 months after its glittering debut, the Moulin Rouge goes into bankruptcy. By 1955, Las Vegas isn't just the fastest-growing city in America. It's the fastest-growing business. The mob is skimming millions from their gambling empire and hiding the funds from the IRS. But that creates another problem. How do they use the skimmed money to expand operations without drawing attention from the feds? They need legit funding from a financial institution willing to work with them. Help comes from an unexpected source, a Mormon banker. You know, Audible has a brand new collection of exclusive thrillers.
Every move is made more exciting by captivating sound design, eerie soundscapes, and dynamic performances. I just downloaded The Grand Opening by Carl Weber. It's a mystery about a family business in a small southern town, and there are secrets around every turn. You know, when I'm listening, the time just disappears, getting completely immersed in the story and the performances. And as an Audible member, you get to keep one title a month from their entire catalog, including bestsellers and new releases. So come on, listen along. New members can try Audible now free for 30 days. Head on over to audible.com/BW or just text BW to 500-500. That's audible.com/BW or text BW to 500-500 to try Audible free for 30 days. As business owners and managers, you use software for your business every day. You use one piece of software to manage your customers, another to manage your employees, another to manage your finances, and the list goes on. You buy these pieces independently and hope they fit neatly together like a puzzle. And then you find out the hard way that they don't, and you end up with a mess at the heart of your business operations. Does any of this sound familiar? Well, fortunately, Zoho offers a solution to this chaos. It's called Zoho One. Zoho One is a suite of around 50 pre-integrated business applications that fit together beautifully. So instead of dealing with disparate software from multiple vendors with multiple contracts and price points, you deal with one vendor with all the pieces of the business software puzzle neatly put together, offered at a very attractive price. Now, if this sounds interesting to you, you got to check out Zoho One at zoho.one. That's Zoho.one. With Zoho, you're not just licensing apps. You're licensing peace of mind. It's 1955, and Milton Prell needs money for the Sahara. He's heard there's a new source. E. Perry Thomas is a 34-year-old banker with the Bank of Las Vegas, a small institution that opened only a year ago.
Come in, Mr. Prell. Take a seat and tell me how I can help you.
Prell's been around. He's operated gaming businesses from bingo parlors to casinos since the 1930s. He sizes up Thomas, the fresh face, the crisp suit, the upstanding vibe. It's puzzling to Prell. Meeting with such a forthcoming, legit banker, that's a rarity in his world.
I'm looking to expand the Sahara. I need $750,000.
Prell waits for Thomas to laugh and toss him out of the office. In Las Vegas, regional banks are always happy to accept millions in deposits from the gambling business, but no one will lend to a casino owner. It just isn't done. But to Prell's shock, Thomas just smiles and extends his hand across the desk.
I think we can work that out, Mr. Prell.
Prell shakes, grinning like a champ. What so many casino industry leaders truly desire, mobsters or not, is legitimate validation. They want respect. So E. Perry Thomas is going to make it his business to give it to them. And in the process, he'll become very, very rich. What makes this arrangement so surprising is that Thomas comes from a devout Mormon family in Ogden, Utah. There are certain evils that the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints does not condone. Smoking, drinking, eating red meat, and gambling. But nowhere in the doctrine does it stipulate that a Mormon can't loan money to men who make their living off gamblers. Unlike other Mormon bankers who refuse to lend to the casino industry, Thomas sees this as an untapped market, and his involvement will earn him a nickname that sticks: the Quiet Kingmaker. Within 2 years, Thomas's bank's assets leap from $250,000 to $16 million. In the next few years after his loan to the Sahara, Thomas brokers close to a dozen more deals with mob-run casinos. Because of Thomas's success, Mormon leaders reconsider their relationship with the Las Vegas mob empire. Before long,
Mormons begin working as middle management in casinos throughout Sin City, as supervisors, pit bosses, and accountants. Many of them decide that as long as they don't touch the cards and dice, they're doing no harm. Meanwhile, the syndicate sees the strict Mormon belief in clean living as a big plus. No drinking or wild nights out, just responsible, trustworthy behavior. And it's all good for charming, hard-working Thomas, who's similarly at ease with Mormon developers and casino owners alike. But by the early 60s, there's another lending source. Jay Sarno's got a dream. He wants to build an over-the-top Las Vegas-style ancient Rome, and he needs a loan, a big one. He's got a Teamster friend he hopes will give him one.
Hello?
Hey, Jimmy, it's Sarno.
Sarno has known Teamsters Union President Jimmy Hoffa since the early 50s, back when Sarno was laying tile in Miami. Now, Hoffa's a big shot. He can arrange millions in loans from the International Brotherhood of Teamsters Union Pension Fund.
Jay, you son of a gun, what can I do for you?
I need a loan for a place in Vegas. Gonna pull out all the stops. It'll be like walking through St. Peter's Square. More Roman than Rome. You know, classy.
What are you gonna call it?
Caesar's Palace.
Ha, I like that. So it's like Caesar's place.
No apostrophe.
No apostrophe? You kidding me?
My idea is everyone's a Caesar.
Everyone? How the hell does that work?
It's like not just Caesar's place. You come there, you get to be Caesar.
Okay, no apostrophe. So how much do you need?
Sarno pauses and swallows hard.
I'd say 10 million, give or take.
Hoffa doesn't pause. He knows behind the bluster Sarno is a shrewd developer. The man knows Vegas.
I think we can manage that. Of course, there will be my usual finder's fee.
Not a problem, Jimmy, not a problem.
Hoffa gets a 10% cut off the top of all loans. He's regularly funneling pension fund money into Vegas hotels, casinos, and golf courses. Construction is booming. The Strip is expanding like crazy. Perry Thomas's renamed Valley Bank is the discreet go-between for most of the transactions. Hoffa's union becomes one of the biggest creditors in Nevada. The Teamsters Fund becomes a de facto bank for the mob. The loans are technically not illegal, but Hoffa and his corrupt trustees, mostly Midwestern mob bosses, can approve multi-million dollar loans from the pension fund, then bleed the borrowers. As the murky relationship with crime figures deepens, the integrity of the union fund, built on the backs of hardworking men and women, is up for grabs. Tourism is strong. Gaming houses up and down the Strip keep winning, and new casinos spring up so quickly it seems like there's a new one every day. The mob's corrupt hold on the business of Sin City seems unshakable, at least as long as everyone turns a blind eye to what's behind this unprecedented gambling boom. But not everybody in the Nevada government is willing to do that. In fact, there's so much sizzle in this extra-legal market that it catches the attention of another equally powerful organization, the FBI. In our next episode, the mob faces its biggest threat yet when the Nevada government strikes back with force, creating a gangster blacklist to keep hoods out of their own casinos. As the mob and the law battle it out, tourism gets a massive boost when Frank Sinatra's Rat Pack comes to town.
Hey, Prime members, you can binge every episode of Business Wars ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
From Wondery, this is episode 2 of The Birth of Vegas for Business Wars. A quick note about recreations you've been hearing. In most cases, we can't know exactly what was said. Those scenes are dramatizations, but they're based on historical research. We use many sources when researching our stories, but we especially recommend The Money and the Power by Sally Denton and Roger Morris, Las Vegas in the 1950s by Larry D. Gregg, The Greenfelt Jungle by Ed Reed and Ovid Damaris, The Battle for Las Vegas by Dennis N. Griffin, and Las Vegas, An Unconventional History by Michelle Ferrari and Stephen Ives. I'm your host, David Brown. Peter Gilstrap wrote this story. Karen Lowe is our senior producer and editor. Edited and produced by Emily Frost. Voice acting by Michelle Phillippe and Ace Anderson. Sound design by Kyle Randall. Our associate producer is Kate Young. Our producer is Dave Schilling. Our executive producers are Jenny Lauer-Beckman and Marshall Louie. Created by Hernan Lopez for Wondery.
Once upon a beat.
Remember the stories and fables that captured your imagination when you were young? We have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember, remixed and reimagined for the kids in your life today. Yeah. Wondery and Tinkercast are bringing you a music-filled weekly party hosted by me,
DJ Fuge,
and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, spinning tales in the New Kids and Family podcast, Once Upon a Beat, where hip-hop and fables meet. Hey, grown-ups, listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus.
Once Upon a Beat.